Welcome back to The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood. My name is Sonny Bunch. I'm culture editor at The Bulwark. And I'm very pleased to be joined today by Valentina El Harizi. I think I got that. Did I get that?
Yes,
that...
you did.
Perfect. Perfect. Valentina has a film in the Dallas Independent Film Festival Shorts program. This Saturday, this episode will go up on Saturday, and it's you can still buy tickets. They're playing at the Angelica on Mockingbird. It's very exciting. You're going to be there, right?
Yes, I am. I'll be there all 3 days.
Great, great. So you can go watch the short we're going to discuss here in a minute. But I wanted to get Valentina on to talk about the film, but also just about the context of making the film, because it's a really interesting portrait. You know, I'm not going to put I won't describe it in my own words. I'm going to let you describe it. But an interesting portrait of our fascination, obsession, almost capture by social media. And it's really interesting to get her perspective on this, because you are how old? Tell the people.
I'm 18.
18. You just graduated high school. You're off to college. Yep. I have like probably 2 weeks here, right? Pretty soon. So you are in the midst of it. Let's get some background here. When you're in high school, what is your day to day social media consumption like?
So I feel like I've always been a bit of a black sheep with social media. And I really realized how different my habits online were from my peers and my friends when we came back from the pandemic. Because although we were returning to normal life, our social media lives and our relationships had remained unnormal. And I could just, you know, I would see it with my friends, my best friend especially, how she was suffering from extreme body dysmorphia. And she was just completely consumed by looking at pictures and comparing herself to other friends in my school or beauty influencers. And there's just this constant feeling of anxiety, and she couldn't detach herself from her phone. And that was the case not only with her and with her body image, but I would see it also with other people, and just how they interacted was always digitally instead of in person and being present in the moment. And that's when I realized that something had shifted since like when I was a tween to when I started becoming, you know, a young adult. There was a big shift for sure. And, you know, the average teen in the United States spends 9 hours of their day on their phones. And 5 of those hours is on social media. So instead of people engaging in young, healthy teen activities like spending time in person with friends, doing physical activity or like sleep, they're consumed by their screens. And this obviously has very detrimental effects on our well-being, physically and mentally, of course.
I want to go back to something interesting that you highlighted there. You mentioned the pandemic,
yes.
Unprompted, because that it does feel like there is a real disjunction point there in terms of how young people in particular interacted with each other. Did you notice in your relationships with your friends a difference before and after? And before you answer that, let me start with another question. What was your lockdown school experience like? Can I ask how long you were out of school? Like what that experience was? Because you're in where? Bethesda? You're in Bethesda,
yeah,
Maryland?
In Maryland. Right? Yeah. So we had more strict restrictions than other states. And we stayed online for like, I'd say 18 months. Mm-hmm. Or it was like a hybrid experience. And all my friendships became from day to night digital. You know, that was the only way I could keep up with my friends. I couldn't, you know, host parties and see them and walk around in a shopping mall and just, you know, catch up. It was really only through the digital medium where friendships were maintained. And I do feel like you know, we that was the only way of connecting, and it kind of just has stayed there. But also, I think it's kind of unfair to just blame it all on the pandemic, because we're also, you know, before the pandemic, I was really, really young. I was only 13, 14. So I also think as we grow, there's more of this society expectation and pressure to be showing how accomplished you are in your life online, to be showing, you know, oh, I'm going to all these cool parties. I'm, you know, having the best social life, and look how pretty I am. Because also a lot of people find companions or partners through Instagram or other social media apps. So I think part of it was the pandemic, but also I think it's just this growing into this, you know, we're adjusting to this new kind of dating and relationships era where if you don't document everything that's happening to you, then it doesn't really have any meaning. And instead of us being the thing that is happening, we're constantly trying to show what's happening to us, which I think is really sad.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. Again, you mentioned being 13, 14, because that's, you know, technically when you're legally allowed to be on. I mean, I guess, you know.
It depends, yeah.
It depends on how strictly you take the, yes, I am above the age of 13 button when you click it.
There's some states like in Utah who passed legislation that you have to be at least 18 years old to actually if you're not an adult, you are not legally allowed to have social media unless you have your parental consent. But yeah, there's a lot of change happening there with age verification.
Yeah. You say you're kind of a black sheep in terms of social media usage. What is your actual usage like? I mean, are you on Instagram? Do you have TikTok? Like what's your mode of interaction with the world in that sense?
I have Instagram primarily because as an artist, it is a very helpful tool to promote your art and, you know, build an audience that can keep up with your projects. So I have it actually more as a business tool than an actual personal tool. I don't really like messaging through Instagram or any social media apps. I actually have a daily 30-minute screen time for Instagram. I don't have TikTok. I had it in the pandemic, but I find it very addicting, very, very difficult to just leave. And though, you know, I'm conscious about screen addiction and the, you know, the softwares that are programmed to keep you hooked, I just thought it would be better just to get that out of my life. And I've gained a lot more hours of sleep actually after deleting it. And I feel like for me personally, I always prefer a phone call or texting through WhatsApp or some kind of iMessage application. So really, you feel like the conversation is more personal and you're not also being distracted by other notifications about, oh, this person liked this thing, or this person just shared you a reel that's funny. I guess it's funny, but it's also taking a lot of the time of your day where you could be actually creating more meaningful relationships. It's like, it's very ironic because social media's whole premise is to connect people. But at the same time, since we're being connected with 10, 20, 100 times more people than the average Gen X was connected to back in the day, we have a lot more relationships or connections, but they're a lot more shallow. And so there's this kind of loneliness feeling that is pervasive around my generation, that even though they have tons of thousands of followers, they don't really feel like they have maybe even two real friends.
Yes, the more shallow, few deeper relationships is a real problem, or at least it's a big change. It's certainly a big change. So the name of the short is Behind the Scenes. Which is interesting. It's funny. So my friend John Wildman sent me the link to your you're short. And he was like, hey, I think this is somebody you'd like to talk to. And when I sat down to watch it, I was expecting, I'll be honest, I was expecting a documentary.
Yeah.
This is the sort of thing that often gets the documentary treatment. And I was surprised as it started, because I didn't read the whole synopsis, you know, who has time for that? I was surprised as it started that it wasn't, that it was fiction. So I'm curious, from your perspective as a filmmaker, what was it, why did you want to go fiction as opposed to nonfiction with this?
Well, I love documentaries, of course, but I actually was taken aback when I wanted a, you know, I always sort go to films to sometimes when I want to sort out my feelings. There's just something so powerful about storytelling. And I was pretty taken aback when I realized that there wasn't a film that was addressing in a creative manner or in a different way, a more poetic way, these issues that my generation are going through. And so that's why I wanted to write a narrative short on screen addiction as opposed to the factual you know, kind of documentary type short addressing these issues and maybe interviewing real people and their real experiences. Because I personally think with my approach to filmmaking that there's not a more powerful tool if you can make the audience enter into the psyche of the characters and make them understand what they're going through. And maybe by understanding, they can actually relate and see themselves in those characters and feel seen. And that maybe will help them sort out their feelings too.
So why don't you explain to give people the elevator pitch for your movie? What's the setup here? What should folks know as they're walking into the theater that they're going to be seeing here?
They're going to see two realities or two ideals. The first ideal is the image of a perfect couple who loves each other, who are having, you know, they're basically relationship goals that everyone wants to have and be, and they share that all the time online. And then there's another ideal, the ideal of being honest with ourselves and asking the, you know, the ugly questions and confronting maybe the dysfunctions that exist between in a relationship. And I invite you to come to the theater with an open mind, understand what each of these two characters are feeling, and ask yourselves, since when has an image had more value than the real thing?
Let's talk about your influences here, because again, there's a version of this movie that is, you know, kind of more straightforward is the wrong word, but more realist focused, right? And while I was watching it, I was taken aback by how European it feels. There's a lot. It feels like there's a lot of, I don't know, Fellini in there.
Yes, thank you.
But also like Nicholas Winding Refn. It felt like there were definitely kind of some touches like that. You're very young. Just a statement of fact, not the, but
yeah.
Led me to expect kind of a more, I don't know, Instagram-y sort of vibe from it. And it was not that at all. So what were some of your influences when you were, what do you watch? What did you grow up watching?
Well, I am half French, half Argentinian. So a lot of the films that I watched when I was growing up were very maybe niche and maybe not as mainstream as, you know, your typical Marvel or Sony production films here in the US. I grew up watching a lot of Fellini, a lot of French impressionist films that have had a huge impact on this film. I love Napoleon, the 1920s classic film, French film, and I really love how at the time, since films were silent, most of the storytelling was visual. And that was how you said what you wanted to say. So I had that approach with this film as well. I wanted to reside a lot on the visuals, more so than just the dialogue. Because also social media is such a visual medium. We don't really read or listen, we mostly see. And if we like what we see, we might stay on the post. But if we're not intrigued by what we see, we just skip it. It's very, residing on the visuals. So I had that approach when I was making this film. And each act, as you might have seen, is very different visually from the other. The first act is Utopia. So obviously there is a more, you feel more connected to the characters because they're trying to give this perfect impression of themselves. So I chose to film it on a film camera, a real film camera. We were outside. The aspect ratio is, the standard little square aspect ratio, 4:3. And, the whole feel of it is very intimate, romantic, and utopic, because it's a utopic image. And then act two, we enter in this space odyssey kind of world, where you can see the light fixtures on top on some shots, just to highlight how artificial social media life has become. And, the whole environment becomes like a third character in this film, and it takes its own personality in each act and as the story progresses. And in the cycle, it's kind of, well, I don't want to spoil too much, but, there's like a little plot twist that makes us believe they reconcile. And, the filming technique is very different as well. And the lighting as well. We go from a very artificial lighting to a more intimate and natural sunlight kind of lighting.
Let's talk about the actual filming here, the actual physical act of filming, because they're as you mentioned in the opening moments, it's the kind of standard Academy ratio. Did you shoot 8mm or 16mm? What was
16.
What was okay? And it's and it, again, it feels like film. Compared to later, did you switch to a digital camera?
Yeah, we did. Okay. We switched to an Arri Alexa Mini.
Okay. This is just a very basic, but where did you get the cameras from? Did you just, go down to the store and pick them up? What was that process like?
Yeah. I was being guided through my DP. I contacted him. He was actually from Los Angeles, and I didn't go to a film school. This was my this first project. I learned how to be a director, a screenwriter, as I went, through the process. I just followed my instincts with the films I had seen, and for the renting of the cameras, we contacted a film equipment company here in Washington, D.C. called Red Star, and they helped us, find what we needed. But for the film camera, we did have to go to New York City to rent it, because it's very few places actually have real film cameras to film with. But it's a shame, because the environment on set is so different when you have film. There's like these stakes, and it gotta click, and there's this whole pressure, but it works to our benefit. For sure. It's a very crazy story, like the whole production process, like pre-production, production process, because like no famous producer is like sponsoring this film. Really started with an idea of a 16-year-old who wanted to talk about social media. And I wrote the script, and I contacted a DP from LA whom I admired. He liked the script, and the rest is history. I mean, I just hired him with some of my allowance I had a small business, but that I grew in the pandemic on slime. It's called Bellini Slimes. This is like going very deep in my past, but
this is good. This is
but
good.
Yeah, so like a lot of people ask me, how did you finance this? And it's like,
was going to be my next question. You're throwing a lot of words out there, like professional DP and renting film
and they're
cameras,
not cheap.
And like that's not a low cost endeavor.
I know.
At least it's not a zero cost endeavor.
No, not at all. So here it is, the truth. I started a small business when I was 12, when this whole slime craze was like huge online. and it kind of took off. I went to slime conventions all over the U.S. I even sold that. I was a slimer in residence. It's called the title at Slumu Institute in New York City. It's the first, the world's first slime museum. It's huge. It's on Broadway. Go check it out. say hi to Karen for me. With the profits I made, I mean, it really picked off, and I saved all that money, and I was like, you know, one day I'll need it, and I thought I was going to use it for college, but instead I used it for my film, but I wouldn't have it any other way. This was a passion project, and, you know, I'm a firm believer of, you know, if you're going to do something, you got to do it 120%. And so that's what I wanted to do, and that's what I did.
Can I ask what the budget on this was, if you don't mind?
Yeah, it was $50,000.
Okay, yeah, that sounds about right. It looks, I mean, look again, it's a very good looking production, and you have at least what, three different sets here? There's the outdoor in the beginning, the nightclub,
yeah,
the kitchen.
I was lucky because the Glenstone Museum in Potomac, Maryland, it's the U.S. largest private museum. Actually, like, I told them I wanted to shoot the first act there, and they were so supportive, and they let me shoot it for free, exceptionally. But also, the white set where they come back from the club, that's my home. Became a handyman, and I, like, painted it all white. I used this white marley floor that I used from ballet because I used to be a ballerina too. So I taped it all over the floor so it would really be a completely white set. And then, of course, I used the nightclub for the nightclub scene. But yeah, you got to get creative when you're on a budget.
Yeah, yeah. All right, so, you know, you shoot the film, you write the film, you shoot the film. You sit down in the editing room. What was your biggest challenge in terms of getting this film together? Was it a storytelling challenge? Was it getting it under a certain amount of time? Because, you know, you have time limits on these for submissions, for festivals, that sort of thing. What were you doing when you were in the editing bay or working just on, you know, your MacBook Pro or whatever? What was that like?
I'd say the time was definitely an issue. Actually, festivals don't really like long short films. I've learned that through this experience. Normally they like a 12-minute, 15-minute long short, and my original cut was like 27 minutes. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of learning, you know, what scenes I can kind of remove. I really like a slower paced film. So it was kind of learning, you know, what I can remove, what should stay, but always staying truthful to the story and my style, my personal style of filmmaking. But, you know, I managed to cut it to 20 minutes. It's still a bit longer than, you know, the typical short, but, you know, it's also its own story, and I'm not going to sacrifice quality or the plot just so it could earn more space, like slots in different festivals. But yeah, it was so fun. I actually had no idea the power of editing until I started editing. I have a newfound respect for editors and even for performances. Like, you can really make or break an actor by just how the editor does his work. I think that you can enhance an actor's performance so much, or, you know, on the flip side, do damage to it, depending how you edit. So they are really the unsung, underrated heroes in a film.
No, this is one they always say you make a movie three times, when you write it, when you shoot it, and then when you edit it. And the role of the editor is greatly underappreciated, I think,
yes,
in the world of film. So I assume you've shown this to friends, you know, folks you have grown up with digitally and in person. What do they make of it? What is the take of your peers when they see that reality reflected back at them?
I hosted a group of friends at home. I projected the film, and I think they really liked it. I think they kind of just sat there, some of them, and were just thinking about, you know, the whole metaphor with the mirrors. And, you know, I think that a lot of them felt seen, or, you know, we're all kind of guilty of this, discrepancy between what we show online and what we're actually feeling, or how we're in what kind of mental place we're at. And I think that at least starting by being able to acknowledge this is the first step to break away from this pattern of obsession with social media and this obsession with sharing and being the perfect me that you can be. I had one of them who really watched, my best friend. She was like, she's thankfully now doing a lot better. And, you know, I actually had her come on in and help me write some of the script, because I think it's a very therapeutic process. And she felt quite emotional when she saw it. And she was just so thankful that she was able to be part of it and to kind of open her eyes on what was going on. And I think, you know, it's never like a black or white situation. Some days are worse than others. Some days are better. But I think if we could start making educated choices on our habits with social media and really understand the potential harm that there is when we, you know, blindly close our eyes and continue scrolling and continue comparing, it's time to learn different ways to practice mental well-being. And I hope that this film and its partnership with Reboot and Recover can help people have the tools to make these educated choices.
Could you talk about that partnership a little bit?
Yeah, I contacted them after the film was done. I sent them the film and I said, you know, I would really like to film an outro for the film where I, you know, highlight, I talk about your organization, and so I can send viewers to come and check out your organization if they feel like them or someone they know could be affected by screen addiction. And they obviously really liked it, and they said, yes, let's do a partnership. So I, on my film's Instagram, I've done like interviews with their founder, Dr. Stephanie Diaz-Morel, and talking about screen addiction, ways to break free from screen addiction patterns, and ultimately let people know about these resources and treatments that are available to them for free online that can really make a difference.
What's the name of the organization again?
Reboot and Recover.
Reboot and Recover. Make sure to check them out. If you have questions, and look, here's the thing. You know, I have a now 9-year-old daughter, and some of her friends are starting to get phones. And, you know, She said to me, slightly annoyed that she does not have a phone, you know, my friend has 120 followers on TikTok. And I just want to be like, who are these people who are following your 9-year-old friend on TikTok? Like, why is this happening? But also, it just, you know, it's hard. It's hard to balance that desire to be part of the group and be involved with the social scene with, keeping kids' mental health in particular on the right path. Do you have any recommendations for either parents who are trying to figure out how to walk that line, or the kids themselves?
I think that the moment that you don't feel good, that's a really good sign that something there is not working and that we need to make a change. As for parents, I am far from being a parent, but I can see myself in the future being careful with my child and saying, you know, maybe protecting them a bit with their access with their phones, especially at a young age like 9. There's just so many harmful contents online that are, you know, free access to all. And it's really hard to be able to block that. So, you know, I think it is a good choice to maybe wait some time until they actually have access to navigate the whole sea that is social media. I know that there is now a new bill that was passed by the Senate, COSPA, and it actually gives parents regulation rights to control what kind of contents their children will have access to until the age of 17. So now we have to see if the House will also pass it. But yeah, I think that I don't want to say you can never be too safe, but you shouldn't also underestimate the harmful impact and the kind of contents your kids can easily access online. I mean, I don't want to name call anyone, but I know a lot of kids who, when I was really young, 10, were already looking up Pornhub online. And, you know, because it just appears, you know, these links are available to all. And I just don't think it's a healthy thing that kids who are so impressionable could have access to some very gory or, you know, harmful content at such a young age. So it's really trying to find the middle ground. But also, there's nothing better than just spending time. If you want a social life, spend time with your friends in person. There's nothing better. And there's nothing more fulfilling than real connections and not just the endless texting.
Do you find when you're hanging out with your peers that it is an actual in-person, you know, connection, hangout session, or is everybody kind of separately on their phone anyway? Because this is a thing I have certainly seen written about and also a little bit, again, with peers and their kids, is that, like, it's yes, the kids are all together, but they're all kind of in a basement looking at their phones, scrolling, you know, separately. Is that something you've experienced, or?
Yes, unfortunately. And it's, like, incredible. Like, that might be just one of my biggest pet peeves. People who, you know, you're either, like, those iPad kids, for example, who are, you know, dinner, and they just have that huge iPad on the dinner table in a nice restaurant, and instead of like enjoying the food, they're like on their iPads. And the same thing is for, you know, now 18-year-olds, and everyone's on their phones. And personally, if I see that, I just don't have it. I can understand if you check some time to time if there's like an important notification. I can understand that. I'm not a tyrant, but I, you know, it's like, why are we then meeting up if you just want to be on your phone? It's like, and not everyone is like that. There's some people who are also, who like to also call out people who are looking at their phones instead of being present in the moment. And I just think it's also like, you know, some people like that, enjoy those kinds of social interactions that are most like they're hybrid almost. Like you have someone in person, but you're also like checking what's going online. And then there's just some people who don't feel that need as much. And so I mostly hang out with people like that. But it is a difficult experience to go through, especially growing up. You see how more and more people end up being in that friend group that are just like always looking at their phones. But also, you know, you can try to meet to do like a fun activity that would really distract them from their phones, like, you know, go kayaking or something fun and different, and hopefully doing some fun outdoor activities could be a good remedy to get people out. There's actually so many people with vitamin D and C deficiency because of how much they spend inside. Like my doctor won't stop telling me. She's like, it's so good that you have the right levels. Like you wouldn't imagine how many people are deficient. I'm like, just another reason why not to be on your phone. You want to have those vitamins right.
Yeah. It's funny, you know, there's a moment in your film where one character says of the other, you know, remember when you were in the Bahamas and you took it, were you even there?
Yeah.
And there's this social media is, I mean, look, I am no one to judge here. I am a bit of a Twitter addict myself. And there is this idea of social media as a curated existence that you can control entirely, that is appealing, that there's a kernel of an idea there. Like, if you don't have control over your real life, you can control this kind of virtual space, but it is ultimately isolating and kind of empty.
Yeah. And I mean, of course, it, like, everyone wants to show their best version of themselves. You know, I'm not trying to show my worst. I'm always trying to impress, have good relationship, people who think well of me. But I think that the moment it's that control is like a double-edged sword, because at the same time, you have so much control that some people kind of become blinded and start losing self-awareness to the point that they're transforming themselves, metamorphosing to different versions of their me, that aren't really truthful at all, and that they're just these curated online personas that they esteem would be more appealing to the majority instead of being appealing to themselves and who they really are. And that's the problem. When we can't even be genuine with ourselves, how do we want to create real, genuine relationships?
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, that was pretty much everything I wanted to ask. I always like to close these interviews by asking if there's anything I should have asked. If you think there's something folks should know about your movie, or, you know,
I think
what,
one little thing, because you'll see that in my movie, there's like a statue in the scene in the act two. It's a Narcissus statue from the Greek mythology, and it's there to represent, of course, the love of self. And, you know, in the legend, he falls in love with his reflection and he falls inside the water and he dies. And there's a Narcissus flower that grows from the water. And so he's there. He's always surveilling the couple. And they're both kind of Narcissus in their own way. And I'm not calling people who are online Narcissus at all, but I'm saying that there is this kind of obsession with self that has been created because of this control that we want to exceed over our stories and our persona online. And so I think it's important that also people can kind of detach from their image and also fall in love with other people and actually want to fall in love and get to know people genuinely. So that's why it's there. I just wanted to explain for those who see a moving Narcissus statue in the scene. There is a point.
Okay. I feel like this has come up before. People have asked you about the statue.
They were like, what is going on there? Like, he just randomly starts moving, and that was an outtake. But I was like, let's keep it in. Let's make it a bit weird. So a bit surreal. Yeah.
Okay, great. Well, Valentina, thank you for being on the show today. Again, you're going to be at the Dallas Independent Film Festival short program. It's happening right now. If you're listening to this, it's basically going on at the moment. You pick up tickets to the your package is in the I think it's the high school. What's it called? High school
shorts. Yeah, she
high
doesn't even
shorts.
Go there block.
Yeah. So I believe it's playing at the Angelica on Mockingbird if you're in the Dallas area. So check it out. Valentina, thank you for being on the show.
Thank you so much for having me. It was really nice speaking with you.
My name is Sonny Bunch. I'm culture editor at The Bulwark, and I'll be back next week with another episode of The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood. We'll see you guys then.